The reading from this morning is from Maya Angelou, a poem that she wrote for the inauguration of President Clinton. Maybe some of you saw this, as I did, first time read into the air during the inaugural ceremony. And I'm going to read the second half of it because it's going to lead us from where we are right now to where we need to be for deeper than the skin. This is the second half of On the Pulse of Morning. History, despite its wrenching pain, cannot be unlived, and if faced with courage, need not be lived again. Lift up your eyes upon the day breaking for you. Give birth again to the dream. Women, children, men. Take it into the palms of your hands. Mold it into the shape of your most private need. Sculpt it into the image of your most public self. Lift up your hearts. Each new hour holds new chances for new beginnings. Do not be wedded forever to fear, yoked eternally to brutishness. The horizon leans forward, offering you space to place new steps of change. Here on the pulse of this fine day, you may have the courage to look up and out upon me, the rock, the river, the tree, your country. No less to Midas than the mendicant, no less to you now as the mastodon then. Here on the pulse of this new day, you may have the grace to look up and out and into your sister's eyes, into your brother's face, your country, and say simply, very simply, with hope, good morning. It's a pleasure to see you all here, especially this weekend. I thought it'd be a little thinner. Because after all, you've been through one of the great trials / holidays. I hope that you had a fantastic Thanksgiving. And I hope that you found many things to be grateful for. I am certainly so very thankful. Very, very thankful. Although it may not sound a little later in my sermon, in my talk, I am very grateful for my parents. My parents, the best way to put this is I heard Dr. Cornell West say this once, I'm here because somebody loved me. I'm grateful for the college right down the street, the College of William and Mary, who helped me formalize my thinking and brought me into the world of thought, the history of thought. I thank this church, the Unitarian Universalist Church, for giving me a community for those thoughts to be expressed and welcomed and grown and challenged. And so I thank you all. I am grateful that on a day that you could have said, nah, I'll stay at home, that you came out to hear someone talk about a topic that's not necessarily very happy. Deeper than the skin. I'd like to invoke a Native tradition that I actually encountered here in Williamsburg, and that's this. This enables me to speak before you use, because I know that probably half of you know more of what I'm talking about than I do. So thank you for your patience on that. But the Native tradition is this. In speaking to the circle, you acknowledge the wisdom that there is in this circle. You acknowledge the life experience that there each of you have. You bring into this room with you. And in saying this, I say that all I know is my experience. And so, with that in mind, I ask you permission. May I tell my story? Thank you. Deeper than the skin is the phrase that my friend Reggie Harris and I thought up to describe our friendship. He's an African-American man. I think many of you know Reggie. Do you know Reggie? You've seen Reggie? We've been friends for 30 years. He was born in Philadelphia. We're born 3 days apart, me here, just upriver in Richmond, Virginia. And through all of those directions that society sets you on as you go, as you grow up, he and I found each other, and we've been talking about race from the beginning of our relationship. And what a gift. When we found out that Reggie's ancestry traces to Hickory Hill Plantation in Ashland, Virginia, a place that I now live, We felt like we'd sort of been flacked on the head by the universe to say, you have a story to tell. And I'm sorry that he's not here, and I will try to represent him as best I can, only through the lens of my experience. But just know that there is a partner who is absent from this moment, from this story, who fills it in beautifully. And just how many of you saw us when we gave our speech in Williamsburg at the theater? That's fantastic. Fantastic. This story starts 11,700 years ago, for all you geologists. The Holocene glacial retreat left boulders in the James. At the time it was not called the James. It was called the Monacan, it was called the Powhatan, and then when the English sailed up it and stopped where the rocks stopped them, it was named in honor of their king, the James River. I was born beside that river. That place became a trading post, became the capital of the state of the colony at the time of the state. It became the capital of a foreign country. It became my hometown. And that defeated capital of that foreign country, unlike any other that I'm aware of in history, was left to tell its own story, write its own history, create its own mythology and its own nostalgia. As I drive up and down Interstate 95, and it seems like every year there's a new Confederate flag added somewhere beside the highway, I was raised in that nostalgia. The people who told me about the world, the kind, wonderful, nice people who made me who I am, who told me who I was in this world, told me a half story about half the people. I grew up beside the Jefferson Davis Highway. To get into town, we cross the Robert E. Lee Bridge. To get to the Champs-Élysées of the South, where Richmond was designed to be the Paris of the New World, the Broad Boulevard was a monument avenue. 60-foot-high statues placed there, I'm sure you're well aware. Jefferson Davis, Robert E. Lee, Stonewall Jackson, Jeb Stuart. Placed there, the earliest one was in the 1890s by the Daughters of the Confederacy. The last one was put up in 1927. Those statues to my family, no big deal. It was just how the world was. Half a story. Did we know? As we drove my dad to work as the Chesapeake and Ohio Railroad, we went to Main Street Station in Richmond. When you go on 95 from the south, you almost run into the clock tower. It's like me saying hello to my dad. Do we know that a couple hundred yards from there, 300,000 human beings were brought ashore in chains and sold into another existence? Was that part of the copious amount of Virginia history I got? I'm sure there are plenty of people here who went to the Virginia school system. We got, I don't know, several, it seemed like 20 years of Virginia history. And were we ever told about this? Absolutely not. Eradicated. My parents probably told me the story that they were told. And at the time, that's all the story there was. If you go to the National Civil War Museum in Richmond, there's a little exhibit about a woman who basically, after the Civil War, had charge of all the textbooks that went into the school. She essentially edited them and made them essentially a monument to the Confederacy. So what do we do with this? This is what I was handed. I had the opportunity to go to a presentation on the beach at Yorktown, the York River. 35,000 enslaved human beings went ashore there. And on that place, they had Mattapani holy men burn sage to purify the walkway. They had a speech given by an imam who opened the whole thing. Professor had William and Mary from Ghana did a libation ceremony. And this was about forgiveness. And they gave each of us a little vial of water. And I had no idea what this was about until halfway through. And then that thing started burning my hand. Who did I need to forgive when the time came? I sat there as a guy named Russell Hobson, who I've met subsequently, gave a talk called Those Who Came With No Luggage. And then there was a time for us to forgive. And it took me a long time to figure out who I needed to forgive. And I realized I needed to forgive myself. Because as I graduated from that college up the street, I think I'm pointing in the right direction, I don't know. Disoriented, okay, over there, good. I'm all turned around. Williamsburg looked nothing like that when I was there. So, I thought I was thinking about college and I went back there. So, what was I just saying? Yes, who did I need to forgive? I need to forgive myself. The state of Virginia invested a lot in me. I got an incredible high school education in the Richmond Public Schools on the backs of the black kids. Because the next year was court-enforced busing, 1971. And the budgets equaled out. And Richmond became the demographically what it is now. It became almost overnight 89% black. The white flight was, you could almost hear the wind rushing. So I went from an excellent high school, I went to the College of William & Mary, which to the surprise of so many is a state school. I got an incredible education at that school. It was perfect for me to take me from where I was, plucked out of that place, and then introduced me to the rest of the world. And so I left. I bought a mostly orange Datsun 510 station wagon and drove to Boston, Massachusetts, where more people agree with me. It was an incredible music scene, but I think it took 1 week of living there. 1 week, there was a Pulitzer Prize-winning photograph from this town hall, the city plaza. A black man was being beaten by several white men with an American flag. These were Charlestown protesters just fighting the first black person they actually ran into. So Boston, Richmond, the South is not a geographic region. The South is a state of mind. It's absolutely everywhere. And when I give this talk all over the country, sometimes it's easy for Northerners to point their fingers and say, no matter where you're from in these United States, in some way you've been told a half story about half the people. Well, this ceremony on the beach, when I poured that water out to forgive myself, it started a conversation with my ancestors because somebody who looked a lot like me was there at that moment. In fact, Jess Sapaglio, who is not here now because she just had a baby, we'll see that later, took Reggie and I out to dig at Jamestown, where they were digging what they think is the foundation of the first enslaved human in the New World. Her name was Angela. And we stood there at that place. Somebody who looked a lot like me was there at that time. Somebody who was a lot like me survived 1 in 4 through the starving years. Somebody who looked a lot like me introduced a plant from Jamaica that turned the economy of Virginia and the United States around. And somebody like me was there when it went from survival to doing pretty well, to by the time it got to the 1850s and spread all the way out to the Mississippi, it had created the largest, wealthiest aristocracy on the face of the earth. All from the cradle of the James, and all never talked about. So I wrote a song having this little discussion with my ancestors. And being my ancestors, they talk back to me. I do. names on moss-covered stones. I don't know you, but you were I. What you did to survive. You left awake so wide. To me, I wash my hands down by the river. I wash my hands of you, but you keep staring back from the mirror to remind me again of the skin I'm in. You couldn't know me. That I might live and breathe to carry on your name, my ungrateful crime is pointing fingers through time. The matter, don't you like it? Don't you like being heard? Don't you like the first choice? Don't you like the last word? Don't you like that you don't have to know what this is about? Be deaf, dumb, and blind, get the benefit of the doubt. To walk through this world in a velvet cocoon that everybody else can see, except of course you, because you are everybody. Your true is true, that's what I handed to you. What we are handed and what we pass on is everything. My friend Reggie and I decided to take a pilgrimage to sort of talk about this. So we took a ride that took us from upstate New York to New Orleans, 23 hours in the car, so we could talk about how to do this. Eventually, we did talk about this. We talked about everything else. But we went to the Whitney Plantation and Slavery Museum just outside of New Orleans. Now, maybe some of you have been there. It's a brand new museum put together in the last few years by a guy from New Orleans who purchased the plantation and tried to restore it to its original situation as best they could and do the research on all of the people who passed through that point in history. At its peak, it had 250 slaves. It was run by a woman who was sort of an outcast from New Orleans. So the plantation itself was a little surprising. It wasn't Tara. It was just kind of utilitarian. And there wasn't a lot of stuff there. It was, I have to say, a little disappointing. Because really they couldn't show you what they needed to show you. They could tell you about it. And they had obelisks with the names of all the human beings who had passed through there in slavery, identifying each one in the country they came from. They'd done a lot of scholarship on that. There's something different about being told and about seeing. For instance, if you go to the National Civil Rights Museum in Memphis, literally you walk into the Lorraine Motel. You walk onto a bus at some point from the Montgomery bus boycott. There's a statue of Rosa Parks sitting right there with the speaker saying, "Get out that seat, get out that seat." You walk up to the third floor to room 306 where Dr. King spent the last minutes of his life, and they have restored that room right back to the food on a tray, to the Zenith television set. That you feel. For some reason, the only thing I felt was very strange because I had never been in a situation where, and if you're from Louisiana, this is normal for you. I was down here and the water was up there. Very weird. So, the tour was, as I said, mostly explanatory. And Reggie and I went to this place, and the guide tried, we just would ask questions, she would answer as many questions as she could about the conditions under slavery and what it meant in the daily life of everyone. The people who ran it, the people who worked it. And so at the end they said, you can go back anywhere you want to on the trail. And so we chose to go back to a church. And this church is sort of out of time. It was done after emancipation. It was built by freed blacks somewhere else, donated and then brought to that place. And it was called the Antioch Church, as in anti-yoke, as in free. And it was created so that the freed blacks could then have formal burials, something that did not occur under slavery. In that church is a piece of art. It's really 40 pieces of art, created by an artist named Woodrow Nash. And 40 statues of the children who were present on that plantation at the time of emancipation. And their faces are somewhat abstracted, but their bodies convey this incredible human thing. They're standing like this, their head tilted, sort of like waiting for you to respond, waiting for you to answer. The ones that are sitting on the floor are seated like kids, you know, in a classroom, their head tilted, waiting for something to say. What are we to say to them? And Reggie and I decided that what they're asking is, what will it mean to be free? And here we are from just so many generations later. What do we say to someone when we know that freedom would just be a word? That their life would essentially be outlawed, that lynching would move indoors, etc., etc., etc. But the hopeful thing that finally rose up was what you carry inside of you will one day read a poem to the most powerful man in the world. Indeed, what you carry inside of you will one day be the most powerful man in the world. And so I imagined into the future, what will our children say about us? What will we carry forward in us? The fact that you're here this morning as Unitarian Universalists and guests, we have the freedom and the time and the energy to think forward and to try and shape this world. And it's not enough to just agree that of the inherent worth and dignity of each individual on Earth. It's not enough to say, yeah, that's true. It's not what's written down, it's what we do. So handed all of this, what do we do with it? I remember a line from George Carlin. He said, we've been given the wealthiest civilization in history and all we've made is tennis shoes that light up. It's time to give the cockroaches their turn. I'm not that far along. But I will say this, it becomes daunting as to what we do. But I know that UU churches all across the country and the world have undertaken to dismantle white privilege. And we work collectively that way. We're here this morning collectively. Individually, the largest change in the world will come between us. The relationships we foster will be the biggest change that we can make on earth. Side by side with your life and the trail that it takes are 100 other lives in America. If you take a moment to step outside of your path to greet someone who is different than you, if you take the opportunity to invite that relationship into your life, you will be taking a monumental step, because in the middle is the future. The future will not look like any of us. You don't have to think very far back in your own hometown to where you would be tarred and feathered for your beliefs now. The future, changing as fast as it is, where we meet will be the future. Because we don't go there with the idea of bringing someone over to our side. We go there with the willingness to be changed. We must be willing to be changed. And that change will be the future. And it's beautiful to be here today. I've been here many times on this stage. And it's beautiful to be able to talk about something so personal to me at a time Reggie and I did not know that the 2016 election would go the way it went, and that hate would be such a big part, that even in Charlottesville, Virginia, that hate would manifest itself. If you think it's the worst time in U.S. history, you failed history. There are people in the world who face far larger things than this. Heroes, heroines. I want to sing about two of them.
Shoulders of giants, one more. Hour of need.